I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Call me by your name, the lovers say, and I'll call you by mine. In the movie that's running strong for Oscar honors, that breathless wordplay is all about self-discovery in mad love for the other. The lovers are young men, ages 17 and 24, on the Italian coast. So it is a gay movie, like and quite unlike last year's best picture, Moonlight. But is there a movie trend here toward tenderness and tolerance? Some said Call Me By Your Name isn't gay enough, too postcard perfect to be real. No, no, the author Andre Aciman is telling us, the secret is that there's nothing in his novel or the movie it became that we don't all know from experience. Those ghosts of desire and shame in every romance, hunger facing fear, infatuation checked by inhibition. Andre Aciman was born into a Jewish family, mid-20th century, in Egypt's famously fluid city on the Mediterranean, Alexandria. He teaches writing at City University of New York and lives on the Upper West Side, where he and his wife raised three children. In his writing room with a view of Central Park last week, we picked up a conversation from 7 years ago, starting with his breakthrough into movies. A gay movie, yes, but as he feels it, really beyond gender.
There have been some gay movies. There have always been gay movies, but they've never been so visible and so well-received and have created an impact, and it's a sort of a wave that has come. But who knows?
You call it a gay movie, which it surely is, but for me, it's a marker here of a certain tenderness surfacing in our culture when you might least have expected it, but it's notable.
I mean, there are many ways of looking at this film. On one hand, it is a gay story because it's about two men who fall in love. Unavoidable. But I think the majority of people who see it and who write to me all the time, they're always saying that it is really, it's not a way of denying its gayness. It's that they see that it's more than just that. It's about two individuals who fall in love. And the story itself is this study of how something begins from nothing and becomes obsessive and keeps sort of blossoming and becoming more and more intense until it erupts into a confession of love. And, of course, comes the rest. But it's a study. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's an étude of what happens to an individual who is suddenly, probably unexpectedly, drawn to another person and cannot understand it.
Yeah. Some people have said it's not gay enough for certain gay tastes. It needs to be darker, more oppositional, more outrageous.
Now, I located it in the middle 80s, which was the initial date of the novel. But by the mid 80s, there was an AIDS crisis. I didn't want AIDS to come in the way of the attraction of the two men. I didn't want that to sort of dispel what was so intense between them. Nor did I want there to be what is always going to happen in movies about gay men, and particularly gay men. It's the fact that there's a sort of police state out there, prejudice, danger, people getting clobbered, attacked because they're gay. I didn't want any of that to happen. So by sort of expelling all that, what you're left with is simply the story of an attraction, which becomes, of course, love.
That's the way I felt it, and brave in a certain way, but really about the whole mystery of these feelings, gay or straight or something maybe entirely different. I mean, what difference does it make in the end that the sex is same sex?
It's about attraction. You know, as long as you don't hurt anybody, everything is okay in my book. And I think the father's speech in the book makes that, makes that very clear. There is nothing that is prohibited. Although, on the other hand, what I was fascinated by is what is inhibited. What really happens between two individuals is that there's an inhibition. Desire always is accompanied by shame, by the denial. We don't want to say to somebody, I want to touch you. We are embarrassed by that. And I love the example that I'm obsessed with, is you're at a subway station or a bus station every day and you see the same person. I had one of those things where she was there every morning at the tramway station in Rome, and I would see her and I desired her. And of course, there was no way I was ever going to tell her that I was attracted to her, that I was in love with her. I didn't know a thing about her, but I was thinking about her all the time. And sometimes I would say to myself, does she know what I did to myself last night while I was alone? Would she ever suspect? And it's the kind of thing that happens to us all the time. We're always thinking of other people, and we don't say anything because we can't.
So how did these two men sort of, and how did you, the writer, sort of liberate, plunge into this overwhelming energy of desire, but specifically of an adolescent awakening, this kind of frenzy of nerve endings, desire, but rapture, deep, deep downs too, of inadequacy and despair and fear.
Do you think they're any different to somebody who is in his 70s and who's attracted to somebody else?
No, I'm learning otherwise, yeah.
No, it's the same exact thing. That's why this coming of age thing that everybody says about the film and about the novel is, I think, partly irrelevant, because we are no different at the age of 12 than we are at the age of 70.
70 is the new 12, you mean?
Yeah, why not? It could make it 80. My father was still gallivanting when he was 92. So, you know, I don't know what he did, but I knew there were women in his life. And my mother did not like it, so there must have been something going on.
How did you imagine this atmosphere in the book of utter permissiveness at a practical level? The boy never questions his freedom to do anything he wants. An atmosphere in which not only the boy seems utterly uninhibited in practice, but also in his head. He's so thrilled to be discovering something. And the parents, it turns out, are watching very carefully, but very, very indulgently. I mean, who's had a family structure like that around them?
I did.
Really?
Yes. I grew up like that, and my father grew up like that. And his parents were born in the 1800s. So, true, I was born in Alexandria, Egypt, where things were far more permissive. But the mores were looser. And they were not just loose and decadent. They were accepting. Whatever you did is fine. And nobody ever questioned. Yeah, oh, absolutely. My grandmother would give me money and expect me not to buy books this time, but go and become a man. That's what she used to call it. Become a man. So, I mean, it was a very permissive society, and I grew up like that. And there was never a time when my father would ever say anything that I did was wrong. If anything, he would say, isn't she too fat for you? Something like that. But otherwise, it was all permissive.
Come back, because I think it's the way you think about it, to the writer's project here.
Yeah.
When I talk with you, all roads lead to Proust, or come from Proust. And I'm thinking specifically of something you wrote about the great Proust and his own professional study of feelings. Can I read you a passage that you wrote about the great man? Proust, this cross between Freud, Woody Allen, and Murphy of Murphy's Law is one of us. How admirable his knowledge that it is always better to feel something, anything, than to feel nothing at all. That human beings should and want to feel things, and that we are, each of us, heat-seeking subjects, starved for feeling, which is why, even at the risk of getting hurt or making tremendous fools of ourselves, we will not shirk from being drawn to certain places, to certain objects, certain odors, to art, to tears, to plants, to writing, to memory, to music, to vice, and of course to other human beings, because by so doing, each of us finds a secret, private conduit to an inner life that is not just our new life, but our true life. I'm also thinking of a famous Henry James line in a letter to somebody, but he said, art makes life. And you end up concluding in this piece on Proust that it's almost better than life. It's more than life.
I think Proust thought so too. People like to say that art comes from life, that art is indebted to life, that basically art is an imitation or an inspiration from life. I think it's the other way around. Life is, in fact, very uninventive. The plot of life is not so interesting. And I think that art is a different category altogether that supersedes life, that is better than life. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. I like lasagna, I like sleeping with people and all that stuff. But fundamentally, there is something that is extremely resonant about art that life itself is not capable of giving.
And that the artist's job is essentially to find, refine, develop, understand, identify, map feelings that if he hadn't done it, wouldn't have been realized.
That's true.
You remember a moment in Proust where his grandmother is dying or has just died, and he's troubled by the fact that his overwhelming feeling is that he has no feeling about it. And what can he do to surface that in a way that could qualify as a genuine emotion? But this is what the artist is doing too.
Well, in Proust, of course, the emotion comes, but it comes a year later when he's least expecting it, because it was bound to come. But that,
it comes in tears, as I remember.
He explodes. It basically, there's an eruption of tears, and he suddenly doesn't understand even why he's crying until he remembers that it's his grandmother that he's mourning, long after he thought he was well over her death. In fact, he never suffered. He couldn't care less. Hmm. But that also tells us something. It tells us that on one hand, he was focused on his own feelings and seeing that he had no feelings. But then he realizes that through the vehicle of writing about this,
exactly,
he has the feelings. And I think that people who tell you that art is life and life is art, I think are mistaken. Art is a different category altogether. I can't say it's better than life, because that would be foolish, but it formalizes certain things that happen in life so that we can almost touch them in a way that is superior to the way that they are given to us in life, where everything is so elusive. And art is no patience with things that sort of escape us. If anything, an artist or a writer particularly wants to hold on to things for as long as he can. And as you notice from the sentence that you just read, the sentence doesn't want to end. It's on to something, and it keeps going, and it's enchanted by itself. Mm. And, of course, that's called self-indulgence on one hand. But on the other hand, what one wants to do is to create a music that will carry you over to whatever it is that you want to say or that you're trying to unearth.
Yeah, I think that's good. It helps to think of it. How do I make music out of this mystery, out of this scene or these feelings?
It's always music. At the end, you basically, writing is a form of music. Not as good as music, but close.
Andre Aciman is our guest, the novelist of Call Me By Your Name. Coming up, one writer's grammar of desire. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. In the movie Call Me By Your Name, little sparks fly when the precocious 17-year-old Elio first meets the graduate student Oliver, who's come to stay and study at Elio's parents' house in northern Italy. When wild flames finally burst open, the guys wonder what took so long.
God, we wasted so many days. Why didn't you give me a sign?
I did.
You didn't give me a sign.
I did.
When?
You remember when we were playing volleyball and I touched you? Just to show you that I liked you. And the way you reacted made me feel like I molested you.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I just decided I should keep my distance.
Outline the project you set yourself in this book, which became the movie, mm-hmm. Call Me By Your Name. What was it you set out to define, so to speak, or put in words? And then I'm dying to know when you thought you got it. I've got what I'm looking for here in this kind of crazed passion of a boy for a man in his 20s.
Was it a project? I'm not aware of it as a project, because it came quite spontaneously to me, in the way that the way it comes to the character Elio, when it comes basically out of left field, he's not expecting it. It came to me in the same exact way. I was not expecting to write even a gay story. I thought I was going to write a story about myself arriving in a house that I loved because I had seen pictures of it. And sure enough, at some point I said, no, I can't be arriving to the house. I live in the house. So somebody else has to arrive. It was almost like a projection of myself onto somebody else. And of course, it turned out to be a male and not a female arriving in a car, which would have been my instinct rather. But once that started, then it just took off and went in that direction. And I never thought I was going to write a book. I thought I was writing a few pages about Italy, about a house, about whatever it is that suddenly blossomed between two people. And of course, nothing ever was going to happen. But I got into it. I liked what I was doing. I was enjoying it. I was carried away. And the next thing I knew, 3 months later, I had a book done, which wow. I had never expected. I was writing Eight White Nights, which was giving me a lot of trouble. And this was just basically an escape. And I had to get it done really fast because I wanted to get back to Eight White Nights.
Eight White Nights is a book about a relationship that doesn't take off, that can't take off, that can't meet somehow, a man and a woman.
Well, yes, they can't meet, or at least they have difficulty because I think the main character is after something that may not exist in life. He's after romance. And he is not inhibited, she is not inhibited, but he's looking for some form of inhibition that will at least propel that thing called romance, which is almost a literary gesture. He wants the flirtation to last longer than it normally does in today's world. The beauty of a gay story is that there is an inhibition there that is implicit already. There's something slightly forbidden about it. Even though Elliot doesn't feel that there's anything wrong, he knows that he's crossing a line if he were to tell Oliver, who's so masculine, that he's attracted to him. So he feels he has to be cautious. So there is an inhibition. In Eight White Nights, the inhibition is almost voluntary as opposed to instinctive or sort of mandated by the situation.
Funny thing about that novel, Eight White Nights, 7 years ago, March 2011, Andre Aciman and I recorded a conversation about it, a very different sort of love story, but unmistakably the same Aciman. This is about a man who meets a woman at a party on Christmas Eve. She says, "I am Clara," and he is bewitched from that moment, but he's also frozen, and they meet for eight nights. We're not quite sure what happens after that, but there's a passage in the fourth night where he buys her a CD.
Yes. "I walked into Starbucks, ordered the same coffee infused with mocha she had brought me along yesterday, and opened one CD box after the other. I liked the post-Christmas crowd, tourists milling around Lincoln Center, and so many New Yorkers off for the day. I still had two presents to buy. Then I realized that what I truly wanted to do was to buy Clara a present. Why buy me a present? Because is a terrible reason. Because you changed everything. Because as soon as you touch a day in my life, it changes color, like one of those mood rings. Because if you so much as graze my skin, that part of me is burned forever. Here, see this elbow? You tapped it once when we walked by the bar the other night. It hasn't forgotten. See this hand? It held the tips of all your fingers when you cried. And as for my forehead, you once said you liked it, and ever since my thoughts are no longer the same. Because you make me like my life, who I am, and if everything stops here, not to have met you would be like having lived in a north country and never tasted a single tropical fruit. Cherry moya, mango, guava, papaya, I'll name them all like the stations of the cross, or the towns to Compostela, or the stations on the Broadway local line, including the ghost station under 91st Street, which is where you and I, Clara, drink of the same blood, like two shades from the underworld who need to time out together before heading back to what are called the living."
It's funny because these are sometimes very unlovable people. They're solipsistic. They have no work. They're rather idle. And yet they're incredibly winsome. And when they reflect on their own excitement about love, they're almost an ideal. Are they not?
I think that's what, if you want to call it art, that's what art does. It takes the ordinary, the absolutely ordinary day-to-day humdrum stuff, the stuff we ignore, and it magnifies it and keeps magnifying it and magnifies it again and again and again, not till it swells and explodes, but till it becomes big enough for you to finally see what it is that your day was like under a microscope. I wrote the story of Call Me By Your Name because I was interested in how is it that this person is going to incubate desire for longer than it would normally take in today's world among people who are in their 20s. I wanted him to be so inhibited that the tension would essentially become a feature of his desire. And what happens is that a lot of people write to me and they say, you've captured exactly what I go through now and then every time I'm attracted to someone and I cannot quite understand what it is. I don't think I captured it, but I kind of mapped it out for people to say, I have gone through the same things. These are the steps of an obsession, of an infatuation, or even of a love. I don't even know what the meaning of infatuation or love is because these are heavy-handed words that I try to avoid using. I never use the word love in Call Me By Your Name or in Eight White Nights. I avoid that word.
Interesting. The preacher's rule is never use the word love in a sermon unless you're quoting scripture.
Well, there you have it. I love this tea. I love this cake. That's fine. But I love you. We never say that. We never say it not because we don't believe in it, but because as a writer, if you use the word love, you've just basically calcified the whole process. And it now sort of is a lump and you can't get rid of it.
This is serious stuff.
I think it is.
It's beautiful.
It is serious. It is, of course, it doesn't compare with famine, with massacres, with all kinds of things that are happening in today's world. But in our little sort of bourgeois universe, these are the big, big, big tragedies of our lives.
I want to know more about what people write to you, but I would have written to you that whole explosion of feeling, insatiable curiosity. Where is he now? What is his elbow looking like this moment? What does he look like under the sun, in the dark? What's he thinking? Is he thinking of me, et cetera? I hope we've all been through that one way or the other about somebody.
We always go through this. We go with it with our employer, with our better halves. What does so-and-so think about me right now? Why did she or he look at me with so much hostility?
Is she safe this minute? Is she on the subway?
Oh, well, that's another one. Yes, we think about those things too. What is she doing? Whom is she speaking to? Whom is she having lunch? My wife is having lunch with somebody today. Who is it? Should I be jealous? Should I be worried?
Come back to what the artist is up to and experimenting with phrases, with scenes. But especially, I'm thinking of the title, Call Me By Your Name. The guys end up playing this sort of game. Why don't you call me by your name? But it's part of, why don't I be you? Why don't I wear your clothes? Why don't I, you give me your shirt? But also, it gets kind of serious. I mean, my body is your body. Or as Elio says, in effect, that he, Oliver, was more myself than I am. Is this a word game or is there some point here about the transparency of people in love? Transparency of people in general, maybe?
I think that what I was really trying to figure out was this thing called intimacy. It's again, a very abstract word. Intimacy, it is when we are no longer inhibited to be who we are. And when we stop being inhibited to be who we are, we can easily become the other person. It's as if all the shields are down and therefore we can just collapse into each other. I wanted that because I think that that is a definition of the perfect relationship. Now, I don't know how one can live this way with somebody else where you're completely sort of fungible one with the other. But I think that in an amorous relationship, this is the ultimate. It's the best. It's where there is no, this other word that always appears in my mind, there is no shame. No shame of being who one is or of wanting what one wants. There are no limits there. Everything's okay. As my dear father once said to me, once you've taken off your clothes, everything is permissible. And God, that saved me so many times. My clothes are off. It's okay now because there are no rules now.
I want to know more about your father.
Oh, my father was a fascinating man.
Who was he? Alexandria, early 20th century.
Yeah.
Place him.
He arrived in Alexandria at the age of 17 from Turkey, from Istanbul. And he spent his whole sort of late adolescence, manhood, down to his 50s in Alexandria, quite wealthy and really enjoying life. And also, because he was a very well-read man, he had also come up with ideas that basically in 1965, 1968, when the whole world was collapsing around us, my father was making fun of everybody because he said, they're rebelling against things that we've all sorted out already. And in fact, I never rebelled against my father. There was nothing to rebel against. I agreed with everything he liked. And everything he did was fine with me. So I'm sure my mother was not happy with it. But in a sense, he was a very broad-minded man. And that's something that I try to work in my own prose even, is that he was not prurient. He was not a dirty person. He was bold, yes. But at the same time, he had good taste in everything. Basically, when you walked with him in the street, he would turn around and say, look what beautiful shoes she's wearing. Things like that. Oh, what beautiful ankles she has. He liked that. And you, when you grow up with somebody like that, you start looking at people all the time, and you're, of course, judging them, which is the worst thing we're told to do. But I do it all the time. I judge people all the time.
Were he and your mother happy?
No, they were miserable. She managed to kill him, I think. He was 93 when he died. But
She took her time.
It took her many decades to finish him off, but she managed. She succeeded in the end. I'm sure he was happy to go.
What were his books?
Oh, he was a great reader. He wanted to be a writer, but he became a businessman.
Well, his son became a writer. That's...
Well, that's something. How it works, you know. Essentially, he's the man who introduced me to Proust. And I read Proust the first time I read him. I read a few, about 40, 50 pages, and I knew this is too close. This is way too good. This is not what I want to be reading now. I was 14 at the time. But then I picked him up again later and devoured it. And, of course, it changes you as a writer. It changes you as a human being. It changes your outlook on life itself and on people as well. So the art of introspection, which is something that I try to practice, is how do you look at yourself? What grammar do we have besides Freud to examine what it is that we're feeling? And are we really seeing what we're feeling, or we're making it up? Don't know. But once you've read about 10 great, great books, you're ready for Proust, and then you will realize that he is the culmination of this huge endeavor, this tradition of the classics. And you realize that this is the best company you could ever have.
No question about it. But I didn't believe it until a woman called into a talk show we did, and she said very simply but lovingly, she said, Christopher, yes, it is very, very long, but it is not difficult. You will like it from the first sentence, and it's true. He never talks down to you. He never talks gobbledygook to you. It's all there.
Well, I'll add one thing, is that he doesn't tell you anything you didn't already know.
That's beautiful.
And because you basically... everything he says, you've thought about, except you never quite articulated it. And he does it for you in his voice, so that you're rediscovering something that you've always known. And this is what I find. I mean, this is going to sound so self-adulatory, which is embarrassing. But I find that a lot of people tell me the same thing. In other words, you've told me things about me that I've always known, and but I've never quite formulated. I never sort of grasped it. And I think that's the job of a writer, is to tell you things, not that you never thought of, new sexual positions that you couldn't even imagine. We're not a Kama Sutra. Our job is to tell you things that you've always known.
Did I ever tell you my Norman Mailer story?
No.
It started with doing a radio program on a new translation of Homer. And people said, come on, we need to do this again. And I said, no. If all the literature we had in the world was Homer, we'd have enough. Same way, if all the music we had in the world was Bach, we'd have enough. If all the human beings we had in the world were Indians from India, we'd have enough. And I mentioned that to Norman Mailer, and he said, Chris, no Proust?
Yeah.
He didn't say no me, no Norman Mailer, or...
No Proust.
No Shakespeare or Dante. He said, no Proust?
He was right. Well, Shakespeare and Dante are there. But I think that Proust is a modern writer. I teach him to high school students. And, of course, they hesitate or they're afraid. And I think by page 10, it's the page-turner. After all, it's about them, is it not?
I love everything you say about Proust, but what is Proust saying about you, do you think?
Oh, he's a fop.
Well, Asuman, that fop, you mean?
Yes. I don't know what he would say. He would say probably something like, oh God, he wants to sound like me, but he just doesn't know how to do it. He can't get close.
Would he say, wow, he's got a Best Picture nomination for a book about young love, and it's sort of like Marcel there at the beach, you know, looking at all those girls.
Right. And but he says, but yeah, but it's not me. It's not me, he will say. He's the best writer of the 20th century. There's no debating it. He's not even the best. He's by far the best. The only other one who comes close because he's a better prose writer is James Joyce.
Yeah.
But that's, I think those are the two giants of our century, and we're lucky to have had them.
And we're lucky to have Andre Aciman. Coming up, his own father's wisdom comes back in Elio's father's voice in Call Me By Your Name.
Look, you had a beautiful friendship. Maybe more than a friendship. And I envy you. In my place, most parents would hope the whole thing goes away. Pray their sons land on their feet, but I am not such a parent.
This is Open Source. Andre Aciman would be the first to tell you that strong emotion is one thing, getting it onto the page or the movie screen is something else. I asked him for a scene that showed his craft of construction, and he went to a movie moment that came inadvertently from a French classical drama of the 17th century.
It's the confession scene when Elio approaches Oliver and tells him, and I'll tell you the origin of the whole passage, because it's almost lifted from a conversation that takes place in Racine, of all things.
So World War II, huh?
Oh, no, this is World War I. Huh. You have to be at least 80 years old to have known any of them.
Huh. I never even heard of the Battle of Piave.
Battle of Piave was one of the most lethal battles in World War I. 170,000 people die.
Is there anything you don't know?
I know nothing, Oliver.
Well, you seem to know more than anybody else around here.
Well, if you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what things.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I thought you should know.
Because you thought I should know?
Because I wanted you to know? Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know.
Now, obviously, Elio at this point is saying absolutely nothing. He hasn't told him anything. He hasn't revealed what he feels. He hasn't, as far as I'm concerned, or as far as Oliver is concerned, he's hearing him just basically putting himself down like any adolescent would do before an older person. But he's actually telling him everything, and he knows that if the other person heeds him and knows what he's saying, then he's obviously reciprocating his feelings or is aware of his feelings as well. And this was a very difficult scene to write because I know that Elio is scared, he is inhibited, he is shy, he's ashamed of himself, but he's speaking, which is a very bold act to do. And he's basically realizes that I've said a lot already. Let me go all the way. I'm not going to flee from this any longer. Of course, when Oliver says, what things that matter? And he says, you know exactly what things. I know exactly what things. He's obviously giving him a hard time. And I wanted to capture that tension. The whole story, I think, until that point, is about the tension that exists when you are about to explode with whatever it is that you're feeling. And we all go through this, at least we go through it at certain points in our lives when we can't sleep, we can't eat, we can't do anything because we're just dying to tell the other person what it is that we feel. Even if we realize that it may not last a long time. But feel it we do, and so we have to speak.
Go back to starting with writing a note to yourself with your mind on another book, to plunging into this pursuit of so many questions, like how long can an infatuation last? What is an infatuation? And then 90 days later, you've got a book, apparently.
Yes.
How does this happen? Where were you?
I was stuck here in this apartment because we were supposed to go to Italy, and we didn't go to Italy. And I was not happy with the fact that we weren't going to be going to Italy to rent a house, which is something we'd been doing for a few years. And so I wanted to be in Italy, and I was here. It was hot. My kids were in camp at the time. I had nothing to do, and I didn't want to do anything else. I was having a hard time with 8 white nights, and it just took off. And that was the summer.
I never believe writers when they say the story wrote itself. The characters got on stage and started talking.
I hate that. I hate that too. But in a way, it was being written so fast.
Mm.
You know, it takes me forever to write a sentence. But this was really fast. And in many cases, I was just, I'll use this word. I don't care. Who cares? This doesn't count. It was always, this doesn't count. Let's go with this. Of course, there are many scenes that were cut off from the book, novel, once it went through the whole editorial process. There was a lot of redundancy, et cetera. The chapter on Rome is twice as long.
And not in the movie.
And not in the movie at all, but in the novel itself, it's a long chapter, and it is twice as long in the actual size of it when I handed in the manuscript. And I realized it was too much.
But could it have written itself other ways? For example, if the child in the villa in Italy had been a girl, 17, and the guy, the ultra guy American, arrives, I mean, could that have taken off under your pen?
Yes, it would have been very exciting too. Easily, easily. I would have enjoyed that too. It didn't come to me that way. Mm-hmm. I've always found it very difficult to put myself in the position of a woman writing about a man. I think I know women.
If it had been a woman 7 years older than the boy who pulled up in the cab.
Oh, gosh, that would have been sexy. I've always liked, when I was that age, I loved women who were much, much older than I was. In fact, one of the girlfriends I had when I was in my mid-20s was in her mid-30s. And it was just right. It was perfect.
Age inappropriate?
I don't even think about these things. Some people raise the subject. I don't even think about it. It doesn't exist in my map. When I was 14, I was crazy about women in their 20s.
For me, one of the pleasures in your book is that it transcends the conversation that we seem to be stuck in about every manner of right, permission, rules, order, tradition.
Well, I have the luxury of always hiding behind the fact that I was born in Alexandria, where these...
A foreigner.
Not just a foreigner, but when you're from Alexandria, yes, you're basically from a city that has historically always been extremely open to where these issues really are aleatory. They're minor. Nobody even thought about these things. Rights, I mean, fluid sexuality, my God. Who was not fluidly sexual, you know, that sort of thing? In that particular universe where I was brought up, this was perfectly normal. I think we are in a society where people are discovering that they have not just rights, which are rightfully theirs, But at the same time, they're finding out that their sexuality that they've been told about may not quite be applicable to what their body tells them they need or what their hearts yearn for. It doesn't matter. And so we're discovering, because some kind of sluice or doorway has been opened, suddenly we're realizing that it's far more complex than we thought. It's not that we're permissive. We realize that even permissiveness is not sufficient. People are basically, what's they say? It's a fluid sexuality. People move from one thing to the other. And there are so many terms that capture that nowadays. People are polyamorous or pansexual or whatever it is. Clearly, the sense is that these male, female is no longer just sufficient to explain how we are sexually.
Are we coming back toward anything like that in this society, or are we veering further and further away, do you think?
I have no idea. I mean, it's very hard to say, because on one hand, people have become extremely open about their sexuality and at the same time extremely prudish, which I don't understand.
Yeah, fearful. He touched me. That's a crime.
God,
now.
No. If you flirt with me, it's a crime, because that's putting a demand on me now. You're forcing me to make a decision. You're putting me in an awkward position that I should not have been put in.
You say it so beautifully, we should leave it there, except I just wonder, do you want to be classified in this world of LGBT or any other letter you can pluck out of the air?
No, it's not sufficient for me. And first of all, I hate labels. I don't have a religion. I don't have a nationality, to be honest. I don't feel I belong to any country, to any land, to any civilization, to any culture, to anything. I'm just, because of my biographical experience of being transplanted and shuttled around the world so much, that I feel that I have no loyalty to anything. And I certainly wouldn't want to be called I'm L or G or B or whatever it is. I hate those terms. A lot of people need them. For example, I don't eat meat, just to give a very corny example, bad metaphor. I don't eat meat because I don't like meat, but I will occasionally eat meat. People say, well, oh, you're a vegetarian. I said, no. Are you a pescatarian? No, I'm not that either. So then there are the other people who basically don't eat anything that was alive. It becomes so reductive. And the one thing any writer should be is the last thing you want to be is reductive. You're supposed to open the doors, to open ambiguity, to expand the ambiguity as opposed to restricting it. So I find that people who have one sexuality but definitely not the other one, crazy. I don't understand it.
Which brings us to this speech in the movie, which everybody raves about. I'd love you to read it. The father speaking to his 17-year-old son after Elio and Oliver have gone to Rome and returned. It's a most extraordinary sort of retroactive permission.
Well, Michael Stuhlbarg does the best job with this speech.
In the film.
He does a fantastic job. And my reading it now is second fiddle to his performance. He did it beautifully, and he had the face that he made while giving that speech is amazing too.
Look, you had a beautiful friendship. Maybe more than a friendship. And I envy you. My place, most parents would hope the whole thing goes away. Pray their sons land on their feet, but I am not such a parent. We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start with someone new. But to make yourself feel nothing so as not to feel anything, what a waste. Have I spoken out of turn? And I'll say one more thing. It'll clear the air. I may have come close, but I never had what you two have. Something always held me back. Or stood in the way. How you live your life is your business. Just remember, our hearts and our bodies are given to us only once. And before you know it, your heart's worn out. And as for your body, there comes a point when no one looks at it, much less wants to come near it. Right now, there's sorrow, pain. Don't kill it. And with it, the joy you felt.
You wrote the whole book in 90 days. How long did that take?
It was not difficult.
Where did it come from? Your dad must have been.
My dad would have said something like that, and he probably did say things like that, but I don't recall them. He was very open. At the same time, he was a very, very tactful human being. And that's what I liked about the combination of tact on one hand, civility on the other, and at the same time, boldness. Because the father is very bold. He's telling him, you know, I know what was going on between the two of you. There's nothing wrong. In fact, I wish I had what you had. And I never come close to it. I came close enough, but didn't go through. It's a very intimate moment between two human beings who are supposed to be at loggerheads with each other in life. I was not. With my father, I was not at loggerheads. I always agreed with him because as far as I was concerned, he knew better, and he did. And I hope that my sons feel the same way. I give the advice I have to give, and then I shut up.
This didn't come out of a conversation with your own kids.
No. But what is important in this scene as well, which nobody understands or nobody really focuses on, is that the father is saying, I'm available to talk about these things. And look, I'm putting my foot forward here. You haven't. You have just been quiet and you've been trying to avoid having this conversation with me. I'm opening it up. I'm the one taking the risk here, says the father. And so with my own children, I hope that even if I don't give them advice, which they might find intrusive, the opportunity to talk to me about it, I would like to think, is available. And they have, in the past, come up with things where I would say things like, have you asked your mother about this? And they said no. So that there was clearly, it was the kind of conversation that they would have with me only, not with their mother. Though with their mother, they discuss so many other things that they won't discuss with me, like how to be practical, what to do with insurance forms, what school should I go to, how do I do this, how do I do that.
It's a very powerful speech in a wonderful book, Andre Aciman. I want to thank you for all of it, including this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. This is a privilege here. Such conversations don't happen very often, as you know.
I know indeed, and we're very, very grateful for them.
Blessed be the mystery of love.
Our interview with Andre Aciman was recorded and edited by Connor Gillies, with help from Becca DiGregorio and Zach Goldhammer, and encouragement from the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Oscar nominee. Good luck to all of them on Sunday, March 4th. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.